This is DeRay, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Kaya talking about the underreported news from the past week with regard to race, justice, and equity, the news that you don't know but should know. Then I sit down and talk to comedians David Bory and Langston Kerman to talk about their new iHeartMedia podcast, My Mama Told Me. Here we go.
Welcome, 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 family, to this week's episode of Pod Save the People. We are so excited to see you, hear you, talk to you, touch you, all the things. I am Kaya Henderson, and you can find me on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
I am Miles E. Johnson. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Pharaoh Rapture.
And this is DeRay, D-E-R-A-Y on Twitter.
We are missing Diara this week. She couldn't be with us, but we are excited to share with you a little bit about what has been going on this week. Lots of news out of Tennessee with the three lawmakers who were reprimanded, two expelled, whatever, put out of the Tennessee legislature. And one, the white lady, the two black men were put out. The white lady was saved. We could talk about that in a minute. But for supporting the citizens of Tennessee as they protested against the lack of action on gun violence. And so the two Justins, representatives, were expelled from the legislature. And there's a vote, I think, today to try to reinstate them. And so this has been an unfolding saga over the last week, with Republicans sinking to a new low, bringing back some super old law. Instead of just reprimanding or censuring them, they have expelled them for violating rules of decorum and largely robbing the people of their elected constituencies a voice in the legislature. So what say you, friends?
That's wild. That's wild. Not surprising that would have happened. I did like when I was watching, like, is like a very losing that word loosely. I liked that the white woman who was also a part of the scandal named it very clearly. There wasn't any type of poking around at it or anything like that. I like that it was named really clearly, which I think is the type of like radical truth in those moments that we need from all people of all races when we're in those situations. I'm not going to hold you. Maybe 10 minutes before I got on this podcast, I saw one of the young men in the airport singing "We Shall Overcome" with an old white lady. And it's the balance between the I'm always going to be kind of shocked about the balance between the absurd and the very, very, almost absurd leaning on comical and the very serious political moments that this generation seems to be able to conjure, where I'm like, am I watching an SNL skit? Is this real? It's a little, it's wild, but you know, those are all my thoughts on that.
So if the two Justins didn't have power, the whole legislature would not be up in arms about them. So clearly there is something about young, true progressives, like not even just progressive in speech, like they like carry the mantle, believe the things, were activists before they became legislators, like whole thing. So shout out to them. And I thought that they managed the moment really well, that like, this could have been a story that like was just a local story, and I don't know who picked it up, but the fact that it became a national galvanizing moment for people is actually an important thing. I think it highlights, you know, what happens in especially those southern states that, you know, we know about Reconstruction and we know the history of this, like when black people get political power, all of a sudden the rules change . So I think all that is actually really great. And I'm interested to see what happens. Do they get reelected? Do they get reappointed? And I do think that the Republicans like inadvertently have created heroes in a place where like you really do, you know, when you galvanize people, like they need more people to vote. That's just like a numbers game. If more people vote, then we will have the things that we want, especially in places like that. And but it's hard to get new voters to come out sometimes because the system's been screwed for so long. And you create heroes like this, and heroes often bring new people to the fold who just would not participate otherwise, especially because this is so wild. You know what I mean? Like, it's not kicking out the white woman was really the thing that, like, I could see people who would never, ever vote be like, oh, we got to go because of this. You know what I mean?
But then on top of that, I mean, I think, one, I feel like the Republicans never cease to amaze me at how low down, dirty they are willing to be in pursuit of power. And so literally to throw people out of their elected positions, not for like murder or rape or campaign finance or whatever, whatever, right? Like, we are literally like talking about somebody who spoke out of turn in the legislature. And so they amaze me. But you're right, DeRay. I think that they are completely misreading this moment, and in their like abject exercising of power are creating the exact opposite, right? So what they've also said is because through the legislative process, they're having a hearing or something today where they could actually vote to reinstate these folks. And the Republicans have threatened that if they reinstate these dudes, that they will withhold education funding and infrastructure funding for Shelby County, which is the county that Memphis is in, which is where these folks are representing from and where, you know, one of the most significant African-American populations is in the state of Tennessee. So if you put these people back into their elected position, you're going to take that out on the backs of school kids and citizens of Memphis in infrastructure funds. Like, this is wild. And this is when the moderate middle America can say, a bridge too far. And this is why, like, we forget the Republicans are losing. They have lost the presidential race. They've lost, like, they won the House, but they lost the Senate. Like, they are losing. And these strong arm tactics, I think, you know, my auntie say what you meant for bad, God meant for good. This may be the thing that ushers a completely different way of being in Tennessee.
Definitely pray so.
What else happened this week?
I know that we were going to talk about the Eldorado Ballroom, but then Monique came out on her Netflix special.
Oh, yeah. I have it downloaded. I haven't watched it, but I have heard the only two things that I've heard about it are one, that it was not very good at all. That's what I heard. I haven't watched it for months. Yes, it was awful.
I heard that too. I'm not going to lie. I heard that too. I haven't watched it, but I heard that too.
But louder.
Monique is a Baltimore girl, so I'm a ride to the wheels fall off. But I heard, but people did say like, not as funny, da-da-da. I don't know.
Yeah, I heard that. And then the big headline that I heard is that she, quote unquote, sort of comes out as bisexual on the thing. And that has all the people talking. What should we know, Miles? What should we know?
You know what? I think that I totally So I thought it was amazing. I thought that she outperformed. So I'm almost on, this is just my opinion, but I'm on almost the opposite end of people who say it's bad. It's not like, oh, I enjoyed it, whatever. I thought it was amazing. I'm counting this as probably like a landmark performance in Black comedy world, period. And I'm going to say that in 10 or 20 years, I'm saying it. Oh, yes, I am.
I see you.
In 10 or 20 years, we're going to look at that special with new eyes because she indicts the church. She talks about the church. She talks about queerness. She talks about transness in a way that is not making fun of transness, but talks about her her Uncle Tina, who she grew up with. And she also talks about being wrongly put in a special education classroom for 3 years and what she experienced there, which is this whole talk about public school. So I do think it was darker, it was slower, and it was more commentary and illumination than it was just, oh, I'm here to make you laugh and punchline, punchline, punchline. But I think that it felt really important when I was watching it. I'm not gonna hold you. And I think the other thing too is, I think when a Black woman who is big and from Baltimore with that kind of attitude gets a mic, you're not going to just hear jokes because she knows too much. So she's going to be like, yeah, comedy special. Now that I got y'all's attention, let's gather around and talk about this. So I feel like she didn't have the luxury of Dave Chappelle, who's going to have five specials to talk about five different things and then more stuff. I think that it was a little bit of that. I got the mic. Who knows when I'll have it again? So that's my opinion.
You better ride for Monique. Come on.
I love it.
I'm riding for Monique in the best car possible. I'm going to put you until Auntie's taxes come in and she's doing some Trump stuff. I am riding with you and I'm riding with you in a new Cadillac.
All right. I'm going to watch it. I'll watch it. I'll tell you what I think.
The other thing that happened to me this week is I went to almost all of the El Dorado Ballroom performances, which is what Salon de Saint-Huron curated these events that were celebrating different types of Black art that maybe wouldn't be always celebrated in academic or contemporary art or theater context. So this was held at Brooklyn Academy of Music, BAM, 10 minutes down the road from me. And it was so good. So I went on, was that Friday? Good Friday. And she had the Clark sisters there. It was amazing. The set design was minimal, beautiful. And Twinkie was there, had a whole organ section, and she got to speak, and they were dressed by Solange. So they were in these slightly avant-garde minimalist clothes with the black theatrical lighting. It was just delicious to look at, and it was so beautiful to see. And the whole of the opera house kind of turned into this this church and turned into a place of like worship, but also a place of reverence for Black music. The Clark sisters, all of them were crying and so appreciative. I think a little bit amazed at the secular crowd who came out to just give them their honors for changing the landscape of music, not just in gospel music, but in music, how we use our voices in music in general. They just have changed music for forever. And it was just so beautiful to witness Saturday.
Can you talk about how do you think they change music outside of gospel music?
For me, the thing that comes to my mind is how they use their voices. I was so amazed that in certain places I felt the energy of Ella Fitzgerald in the room and how they brought that down. But then how they use their voices became main because they were making mainstream music, changed the way how mainstream R&B artists at that time. And I don't know what's going on right now, child, with the era of this whisper singers, but I'm thinking about the 90s and early 2000s, how the gospel howling and how the way that we use our voices have changed. And then, I'm scared to say this, but it's just the true facts of it. I think that we have to look at the horrible R. Kellyfication of stuff. And I think that kind of like towing the line between the modern, the gospel, like I think that they did that for whatever reason. R. Kelly's the first person to come in my mind around really making that kind of mainstream inspirational music, accessible. R. Kelly and Kurt Frith can come in, even though
no, youngster. In fact, this is where the Clark sisters literally changed music, because in the early 90s, I mean, gospel was a whole separate thing, and most of our singers came from the church, but then they went secular. And the Clark sisters sort of pioneered, I call it disco gospel or house gospel, but They're I think like 1993 or 94, You Brought the Sunshine, which was a plain old gospel song, right? Like, think about I Want to Thank You, Heavenly Father. Think about You Brought the Sunshine. There were a whole bunch of gospel hits with mainstream musical arrangements that just hit the airwaves and crashed the wall between gospel and secular. And so they were playing it on the regular radio stations. People were dancing to it in clubs. And like, the, you know, the sacred and the profane are always in tension with one another. And the Clark sisters were one of the first groups that literally knocked down the wall between gospel and secular and made the way for people like Kirk Franklin. And
well, that's what I was saying. I was saying that they cracked. I was trying to think of people who've made careers out of being very successful off of that, the innovation of Clark sisters. And I was like, the first people who I really think about.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
No, I wasn't saying they were innovating it. I was saying the Clark sisters innovated it. And then when we think about who capitalized off of it, we have to name like Art, like somebody like R. Kelly, who just did, even though we know he's, you know, a demon.
They were singing "You Brought the Sunshine in the Club."
Yes. Oh yeah. And I want to thank
club, and you see the sunshine. You get it. I get it.
Okay, no, Miles, you were not there, but Kaya was there. "Jesus Is a Love Song" is God. God said, "Sing that song." You know what a song.
Listen, it's just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And before we go to the next topic, the other El Dorado Ballroom that I went to was on Saturday, and it had Linda Sharrock and Archie Shepp. These are amazing landmark jazz artists. Linda Sharrock is a jazz vocalist who used her voices to howl. She was howling for maybe 30 minutes along with an avant-garde jazz group. When I think of how she hasn't performed in New York City since the 1970s, I get emotional thinking about it, because when you think about what she was, who her contemporaries were maybe Aretha Franklin's and Gladys Knight's and Patti LaBelle's and Nina Simone's, and for her to say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use this Black woman's voice to articulate pain and suffering and be avant-garde and not always, it be a challenging listen. And it's just, I get moved thinking about it and be able to see her. She had a stroke recently, not recently, but 10 years ago. So this was her first comeback performance, and Solange just really did her right. Archie Shepp is 85 years old, you know, so be able to see him on a New York stage on the BAM Opera House was just a blessing. It was just a beautiful night, and just shout out to Sehran, Shabazz, Solange, everybody who I know who had to be a part of making that happen. It was just a great, great, great experience.
I love the intergenerational connections. I love the, not just the honoring for what it means for the veterans, but what it means for the younger artists to be connected to this rich musical legacy. Like, that's exciting.
So this week, my news is about the passing of Kwame Brathwaite. So Kwame Brathwaite was the pioneer of Black is Beautiful. So he really created the imagery around Black is Beautiful that if you Google these his name, you see the images, you're bound to be familiar with a lot of them. And he just passed away, and I was just soaked in his books just documentaries this week to really, really with new eyes, just amazed about how influential he is. When we talk about a Solange, when we talk about a Beyonce, and specifically with Black is King and Lemonade, when we talk about Daughters of the Dust, when we talk about really picturing Black people in film and in editorial photo differently, he busted that door open by photographing people with exclusively natural hair, African jewelry, lighting us differently, lighting us to accentuate the darkness of our skin, not to take it away or to wash it out, really juxtaposing us with vibrant, bright backgrounds that make our skin more luminous, really making it so we weren't always smiling in pictures. That was one thing that I just by myself came up with when watching it, was the beauty, but then watching how so many Black people weren't smiling, which to me is such a big deal when you, maybe I'm a crybaby today. What is going on? But I think about how many I think about how many people before those pictures were taken had to pretend and smile in pictures in order to get their picture taken, or how many Sambo or Aunt Jemima images were created of us smiling and us really pretending to be us pretending to be happy when we were truly in pain, and how these photographs, Kwame's photographs, really just just blew that off and then just showed us looking more contemplative, showed us looking like we were meditating on something, and then also expressed a type of like intelligence through it. Because if we're going through what we're going through in the 60s and 70s, then aren't we thinking? Aren't we contemplating? Aren't we in the quietude of our lives? Aren't we expressing something besides this kind of like, oh, I'm just happy to be here, joy, I'm happy to serve type of images that we were getting in. You know, I don't believe in physical loss when people die. I do believe in the gaining of an ancestor. And I think we just gained a mighty, mighty ancestor who I think, in my personal belief, will be speaking and photographing and creating through the minds and the eyes of so many of our artists. It's just beautiful when I contextualize him with other people like Tyler Mitchell and other young Black photographers. It's just, wow. What a legacy. If you have not heard of him, I would definitely just implore you to research and buy the books and buy the cool coffee table books that have come out in his name too, because it's such a legacy. And it really was that turning point when it comes to Black is Beautiful, Black power and imaging and aestheticizing a new way of seeing Black people. He really was the person who was creating the aesthetic that came with the revolutionary thought of that era.
Thank you for bringing this to the pod, Miles. No idea until I read this article who he was, but I feel like I grew up seeing that imagery, right? I'm a child of the 70s and the 80s, and so a lot of those pictures are familiar to me. And it just made me think, what it really made me think is, I'm sure his mama or his daddy or his grandma or his auntie was like, little boy, you need a real job. You shouldn't be a photographer. And when you think about what using his art and his creativity and his vision to do did for us as a people, I think a lot of times we try to snuff out the creative thing in our young people in pursuit of more traditional careers, things that are going to put food on the table. But this man's vision for photography and for his people literally changed how we see ourselves in the world, right? And like, we needed him. We needed him as an artist. We needed him as a creative. And so shout out to all of the adults who supported his creative vision when he was young, who supported him in doing the thing that I'm sure a lot of people said he shouldn't do, because we would be a different people as Black people in America if it wasn't for Kwame Brathwaite.
This makes me think of the Nikki Giovanni poem that you put us on episodes ago that ends with, I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me because they never understand Black love is Black wealth, and they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy. And when I think about Kwame Brent, I'm just making the connection, is that I just think about Kwame saw us how we see us and had the camera to do it, right? Because we saw those images when we woke up. We saw those images when we went to church and to the corner store and the playground, but those were not the images that were produced en masse. It was always something else. And I had never even thought about somebody sitting down and being like, Black is beautiful, isn't it? Like, as like a concept. So shout out to Kwame, long life. And I'm happy that, you know, they lived in an era where this stuff was not celebrated. There were not retrospectives about him during his time. I mean, I even think about how the protests brought Baldwin into, I mean, Baldwin was always Baldwin, but Baldwin, you know, post-protest becomes, you know, bell hooks for the first time is on the bestseller list all of a sudden because these moments come up. And I think about how beautiful it is that in this moment, people are finally sort of doing the work of celebrating him. And I didn't know that he was with his brother for so long. They were creative partners and his brother died. And he was sort of like, his brother was the storyteller. He was a photographer. His brother was a storyteller. And at the end of his life, he started to tell his own story. So shout out to Kwame. Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
My news this week comes from the dark state of Florida, where your friend, Mr. Ron DeSantis, has introduced to the Florida legislature what amounts to the toughest crackdown on undocumented immigration by any state in more than a decade. Because there is a supermajority of Republicans in the Florida legislature, this bill will probably pass. And Mr. DeSantis says that it is a response to President Biden's quote unquote open borders agenda, which he says has allowed an uncontrolled flow of immigrants to cross into the U.S. from Mexico. What's included in the bill? Well, if you are housing or hiring or transporting undocumented immigrants, then felony charges are in store for you. He will require the hospitals to ask patients their immigration status and report it to the state. They will invalidate out-of-state driver's licenses that are issued to undocumented immigrants. Florida doesn't issue driver's license to undocumented immigrants, but other states do. And in Florida, they will invalidate those. And he will direct the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to, quote unquote, assist federal authorities in enforcing the nation's immigration laws. And they say they're not anti-immigration, but there is a way to immigrate to the United States legally, and they are just trying to deal with illegal immigrants. DeSantis has also proposed eliminating in-state tuition for undocumented students and DACA students, kids who came here when they were too little to make a decision for themselves and have lived here their whole lives. And as you can imagine, this is going to stoke fear and promote racial profiling and all kinds of craziness. And it's actually out of step with how most other Republican-led states are moving at this point. In Republican-led states like Indiana and Utah and Arizona, they've actually been passing sweeping immigration reform that supports undocumented immigrants, providing them with health care and in-state tuition and all kinds of other things, because those states recognize undocumented immigrants' contributions to their state's economy, livelihood, culture, et cetera. It is pronounced that Mr. DeSantis is going after this in this way. The other state, of course, which is also on this train, is Texas. And we know that because we're watching these states bus undocumented immigrants to sanctuary cities. But the reason that this is really important is because, as we all know, Mr. DeSantis has presidential aspirations, and he is on a book tour right now promoting his book, whose subtitle is basically like, Make America Florida. And what he is saying is what he is doing in Florida is a blueprint for what we need to do in the country writ large. And so all of these educational pieces of legislation, the book banning, the anti-immigration stance, he is signaling to their base that this is what he will do when he becomes president. And, you know, this is giving me straight Handmaid's Tale vibes. So this is how we go from here to, you know, the police state. This is how we go to, you know, rampant legalized discrimination and whatnot in ways that we haven't seen before. And I think that people, I brought this to the pod because I think people are not paying attention to death by a thousand cuts. Each one of these small things adds up in really big ways. And, you know, I think about the Holocaust poem, right? They came for this group, they came for that group, they came for whatever. And when it came for me, there was nobody left. You know, Mr. DeSantis has an all-out assault against people of color, against LGBTQ people, against immigrants. And he's not a mathematician, because if you put these groups together, we will swell against him and defeat. But I think it's really important for people to connect the dots and understand the concerted assault on marginalized voices that Mr. DeSantis is not signaling, is shouting that this is what I'm going to do when I become president. So I'm saying this because I don't want nobody to be like, oh my gosh, we didn't think that this was going to happen. We didn't think that the man is telling you what he's going to do. Mama Maya said, when people show you who you are, who they are, believe them. And so this is your Ron DeSantis update.
This is one of those things that I literally didn't hear about until you put in the thing. And I feel like I see a lot of the DeSantis stuff. I clearly remember him putting immigrants on planes to Martha's Vineyard, right? Like, there's like a lot of it that's been so crazy. But one of the things that you highlight so well is that they are just like a steady drip. And you just get, you like, you miss some of it. You're like, I saw this today and I look at this and I'm like, not only, they are going to charge people with third degree felonies. So it could be, you know, it could be something like a landlord renting to somebody, violation of law.
That's right.
You driving your neighbor to the store, violation. I mean, this could be just mass criminalization. So two things come to mind. One is that this is only possible through the police. Like, these laws don't, like, they don't matter unless the police enforce them. And you think about how, you know, this is a part of why the Republicans fund the police so much. It has nothing to do with public safety, but the only way you enforce the racism and bigotry is actually with the police state. That's like, it's not about violence. It's not about homicides. Like, it's actually the enforcement of hate and bigotry is like what you need so you can do it at scale. So that's one. The second thing is, I think about the stark differences between the right and the left. As you look at DeSantis and you're like, the only thing to rally your base is hate and bigotry. That's it. That's like the only, that is the unifying message. Like, this is the thing that brings your people together. It's not a great school system. It's not neighborhoods where people are happy. It's not, it is literally, how can we hurt people that are not us? And that is just so wild. I mean, I know we know it, but I think about it out loud. I'm like, I think about all the stuff on the left. We're uniting over, free yourself, be yourself, love who you want. You know, like, that's the way we unite. And y'all are literally like, how can I hurt anybody that is not me, is actually the subtext of all the decisions you make. And that is just, I don't know, naming it again reminded me of how dangerous and wild it is.
I don't think I'm being dramatic, but I might be being dramatic. It's just genocidal, right? Like, this is like, this is legislation that is made to eradicate a people, either literally either literally physically or through prison. And that's what this is. This is a political way of to me doing something that's genocidal. And I think that's the thing that like just kind of takes my breath away about it too. The other thing that takes my breath away, not that this doesn't take my breath away, the thing that I would like to remind people is sometimes we can be hyper fixed in a celebrity focused world on one character. So I think for so long, Trump was the character. And I think that what DeSantis does show is that there are no, There's no bottom to the evil cartoon characters that the Republican Party will create in order to galvanize people, but then also in order to like remain control. And hyperfixating on one celebrity or one character that they create is not how you transcend this. You really have to talk about the ideas around hate, around fear mongering, and all these and around violence through legislation. That's what you really have to focus on, even when they're giving you one puppet to focus on, because that's the distraction. The bigger ideas and the bigger structures that they're creating and empowering are the things that we need to focus on if we're going to, you know, I feel a little optimistic saying this, but live in a national future that is freer and safer and happier for us all.
I mean, this conversation is making me also think, like, I have Republican friends who don't believe what these people believe, right? And so, like, I'm saying the Republicans will stoop to whatever. And, like, I'm not talking about my Republican friends. I'm talking about these extreme far-right people who, like, DeRay, when you said so clearly the galvanizing messages, how can I hurt anyone who is not like me? Like, I actually don't believe that most Republicans believe that. I think that there is a set of Republicans who believe that. I don't even know if they believe that. They believe that that is the way to get power, right? And so they will pursue that at all costs. But there are a bunch of Republicans who are reasonable and regular and who like their neighbors and who would drive their neighbors to the store for something or whatever, who don't want to be felons as a result. And so the other thing that this makes me sort of wonder is, if you call yourself a Republican, where do you stand in moments like this? If you call yourself a Republican and you're an immigrant, where do you stand in moments like this? Because it is the reasonable people who are going to deliver this country to be the place of freedom, freedom to love, freedom to be, freedom to whatever. And that takes Republicans and Democrats. And so, you know, it's one thing for Dems to rage against the Republicans, but where is the self-correction in the Republican Party from the reasonable middle who does not believe that the only galvanizing force for them is hate and bigotry? Y'all done got me riled up, child. Jesus.
And Kai, to that point, my only push for all of us would be that, like, at a certain point, when you continue to hang around people with compromised morals and values,
people are
right to assume that you share them.
Yeah, okay.
So the Republicans who are like...
Say that one more time. Say that one more time for the people in the back. Like, they didn't hear it.
Yeah, you know, when you hang out with them enough, and I think that there are a number of Republicans, I have friends too, who would be like, I don't believe that. But it's like, that's your party. They're your people.
Those are your people.
And their values, when you continue to stand by the umbrella, you are participating in the values. You are. If you're not calling them and naming them. And that is what I just have to be reminded of. And that is true for all of us, but you know, our values are like, how can people be free? And we fight about, you know, what that looks like and what the contours.
The ways.
But the Republican values literally are like, how do we, you named it right, how do we maintain power? And my addition is, the answer to that for them is always hurt somebody else, right? And the thing that I'll repeat as an organizer, this was like my aha moment that, like, you just cannot do this without the police. Like, literally, it doesn't. You can criminalize all these things and da-da-da, but it just doesn't matter if they aren't the police. So public safety framed as homicides becomes the narrative, even though they are relatively rare. But you need to use that to build the army to enforce this.
Yes.
And it's like, that is actually the story that we need to remind people more. Like, that's why you should be against the crazy funding. The homicide stuff is not really happening. You know, people kill people they have relationships with. So we need to figure out how to help people through conflict. But it's like this sort of stuff. Like, who's going to stop the person driving to the store? The police. Who's going to, you know, respond to the call saying Kai is helping? Yes, it is the police. Okay. So my news, you know, I feel like we've been saying this often, is like, who knew you could be shocked? And then this is in good old Vice. It is a story about the DEA buying customer data from employees inside different companies instead of getting a warrant. And I was truly just surprised. So instead of getting a search warrant for consumer data, the DEA was paying individual employees inside agencies and companies so they could access the data, and then they would give it to the DEA. So this is things like the UPS, or like not just UPS, but like the package industry, airline industries with flight itineraries, dates of birth, seat numbers, private bus companies to say who bought tickets with cash. I mean, it's like, this is definitely what you see on TV in a TV show. I just didn't think, I don't know, I was actually surprised. And when this came to light in 2014 and in 2016, because of Watchdogs, shout out to the Watchdogs, all agencies need Watchdogs, the DEA said to Senator Grassley that they had updated the policies to ban payments to employees of other agencies or quasi-government agencies. But then recently, Senator Wyden's office, he was told that the DEA's policy still allows agents to pay employees inside private companies for access to the data, and that this was a loophole. What a loophole. And this came to light originally because in 2014, there was an Inspector General's office report about Amtrak that found that the DEA paid an Amtrak employee more than $850,000 over a 20-year period for confidential passenger data. And then in 2016, the Office of Inspector General published a report on the DEA's management oversight of its confidential source program. Most of it was about waste, but the report also highlighted that the DEA was paying workers inside companies and agencies for data. Examples include an airline employee received more than $600,000. A parcel employee, so like one of the package companies, was given over $1 million. And then the report also found the DEA used at least 33 Amtrak employees and 8 TSA employees as sources. The final example that I'll give you is that in one of the cases, the DEA paid a security screener to send information to the DEA about passengers carrying large sums of money. Mind you, this is why we have search warrants, so that you have to establish some basis for this information. And let's be clear, it's not like the DEA, it's not like the net sum of this is, you know, you stop the next, you know, terrorist attack. You are literally doing this to try to prove criminalization of people and try to suss out things that you can hem people up on. But this is why we built rules and processes. So I brought it here because hadn't heard of this, legitimately surprised me. And yeah.
I love when you bring things like this to the podcast, DeRay, because it just informs me. But the other thing too is stuff like this just gets, I think I can't think specific about it. I think that I get totally, who needs to be fired? What needs to be overthrown? Yeah, because the system is so thick and so complex, and stories like this remind me about how thick and complex it is, how you can just do things that when you're reading the article, I'm like, am I reading like the plot to like, you know, a secession, some kind of like criminal political series that's going to be auctioned on Netflix. It's just really ridiculous. And I wish, even though this is obviously a media, I wish there was a way, and I often think about ways with DeRay about how to make stories like this a little bit more mainstreamed and a little bit more, I wish people of my generation and a little bit younger knew about these type of situations because we need to know about it. So thank you for bringing to the podcast that educated me. But only thing that makes me want to do is things that I can't talk about publicly, because if it ends up happening, I'm going to incriminate myself.
I want to say shout out to investigative journalists, because if there weren't investigative journalists, we wouldn't know things like this, or things like Mr. Clarence Thomas or Honorable Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas taking all of the money from the rich Republican donor and taking trips on mega yachts and super jets and all of this stuff.
He's going to hell.
Listen, that's the least of where he's going. And stories like this, which show that our law enforcement agencies, once again, see themselves above the law and will do whatever to further their purpose and their power. The thing that is unsatisfying about this to me is, you know, the two senators have said, oh my gosh, this is happening. The DOJ is investigating. The people have until May 8th to respond. And at most, what will happen is, you know, they'll say, you can't do this anymore. And it'll stop for a while. And then they'll figure out some other way to keep this thing going, A, number one. But B, number two, nobody will be held accountable. So who are they? Talk in this article about the agent whose job it is to find these people in these companies that have the information that they want and to bribe them. He should go to jail because he broke the law. All of the people who are hiring these folks, they should go to jail because they broke the law. all of those people who got money, we know who they are because we know how much money they got. They should go to jail because they broke the law and they should pay restitution. Like, the lack of individual accountability is the thing that means this is going to keep going on. Because once Amtrak people and TSA people and stuff see that texting the DEA who's coming through at this particular point lands you in jail and means that you got to pay back money, then they'll stop doing it. But when nothing happens, these people go home with their $1.6 million that they've gotten, then there's no disincentive for these people to not be put in the same compromising position and to do the same thing. So where is the individual accountability? Individual people did this. Yes, it was policy and we should change the policy, but why don't we hold the individuals who did this accountable, both at the federal level and the DEA and in all of these companies that, you know, have provided this information? It's infuriating.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
This week, we welcome comedians David Bory and Langston Kerman to talk about their new iHeartMedia podcast, My Mama Told Me. Each week, they take a deep dive into the most exciting, groundbreaking, and sometimes problematic Black conspiracy theories. It is fascinating. We talk about their career journeys and the modern-day controversy surrounding comedy. It was a really good conversation. I'm happy we had it. Are there certain topics that are just off limits? Is there a way for comedy to spark meaningful, harm-free conversation? I want you to hear. It's great to talk to them. Here we go. Guys, thank you so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Yeah.
Thank you for having us.
We started the podcast in 2016, so we're a couple hundred episodes in, and you are the first comedians we've ever had on the podcast.
So. Oh no. Wow. This is not the way you start.
Poor precedent. Precedent to set.
Excited. You could have. There's so many legitimate people you could have gone through. You're like,
you could have got Monique.
excited to have you both. Let's start with so Langston and David, let's start with how you got to comedy. Like, were you always like the funny kids in school, or did you like watch a special one day and you're like, I want this to be my work? Like, what's your story?
Langston, you go first.
All right, I'll kick this bad boy off. I was not funny in school, or at least not in a way that people believed in me. if that makes sense, it wasn't a thing where people were like, "Yeah, that dude, I bet he's going to be a comedian one day." I was writing very serious poems. I was a spoken word kid for a very long time, and then
do you still do spoken word?
I do not. No, I'd shoot myself in the foot if that were still a thing I was pursuing. but I think that I was always fascinated with the art form. I used to stay up late at night and watch Comic View. And I think like watching though, because that was such like high energy comedy and like people were so like using their bodies and sort of like involving so much of the physical form, that I imagined it was an impossible thing for me because that's not my style. It's not how I move. And I think later in life, I started to expand my palette and see other ways that comedy can be done. And I was like, oh, okay. I can kind of marry some of these things. I'm not going to be Arnaz J, but I might be able to figure out a way to at least be able to be in the same room as somebody that funny.
Okay. And David?
I love that Arnaz J is your bar.
Come on,
like,
baby.
That's like above and below. That's
we amazing. All had our host. He was my favorite host.
Come on. I got it. I guess I was funny. I didn't really care about, I'm not like, I didn't care about being funny. I've always been funny, I guess. I didn't really care about it. It wasn't particularly like a, an interest to me. I didn't grow up watching stand-up. I think mostly because my mom's a foreigner and it was just me and her. So I don't know if a ton of foreigners are like, that's not like your first entrance into like what American humor is. We were big on all the black 90s sitcoms. But I had a friend from high school who started doing stand-up comedy, and I moved to the Bay Area and I didn't know anybody and I was just working. And my friend was like, if you don't have anything to do, it's a good way to meet people. And like, you should try it out. You should try it out. And then I tried it out and it went well. And then here I am.
Wow.
And how did the two of you meet?
Some show.
Yeah, through. I mean, it was stand up. We were telling our sillies and I think met and
we got to LA around the same time, right?
There was a group of black comics in LA that all kind of came in the same era and I think hit it off because it was like, oh, we're young and we're moving with the same energy, so let's all just be cool and kick it when we can.
Yeah.
As you know, I'm an activist, and that is how I spend most of my time. I did listen to the episode where you all made fun of George Washington Carver.
Whoa. I defended the man as passionately as I could. I thought this was going to be a terrible decision to accuse him of not making peanut butter. But then I think we landed on something that actually defended his honor even more.
No, I like the overall point.
It's to say that he's just a peanut butter man is reductive. It makes him less of the hero that he actually was. That man could have made peanut butter rocket fuel, and we don't know it because they made him into a spread guy.
Yeah, to think that like his ultimate contribution was just like peanut butter. Yeah, it does feel very reductive, right? Like, what else was he doing in there? Because like, I maintain, if you left me and a bunch of peanut, if you left me and a bunch of peanuts together, I would figure it out in like a couple weeks.
Yeah,
and I'm not even a scientist. I'm just a guy who likes bread. You know what I mean? So.
Now, what made you all do a podcast? You obviously stand up and, you know, most people's introduction to comedy is not, is like specials or going to comedy shows. I don't think of it as podcasts. Like if I call my dad and was like, comedy pod, he'd be like, what are you talking about? What made you, like, why did you choose this format for your art?
I started the podcast about 3 years ago, 3 years ago. And I've just always been very fascinated with conspiracy theory and specifically, the psyche that sort of lives inside of conspiracy theory, how much of it is rooted in truth, how much of it is connected to something that actually is happening out in the world that we wish we could acknowledge. So we make more sort of like hyperbolic connections in order to make that truth feel active. That's always been exciting to me. And specifically black conspiracy theory felt like a very untouched space. That's not a thing that a lot of people are exploring. And so I was doing it for a little while by myself. And Bori has always been one of my favorite comedians, but also was an excellent guest on the podcast. So when it came down to, as you may know, the burnout that can sometimes happen of being by yourself working on this thing, it was like, oh, we need to maybe consider a co-host. And Bori very graciously was like, yeah, I'm down to come clown with you. And so I think that at least was the impetus of where our partnership came.
Was there a conspiracy theory that brought you to as a guest?
Initially we had talked about, I had been on talking about the Black Illuminati, but I mean, I wanted to do this podcast because I think that there is like, I've just had friends, honestly, my whole life. I've had friends who not I've particularly lost, but maybe they've gotten lost in the idea of black conspiracy theories specifically, because I used to have a joke about it where I talked about, I think that a lot of times black men specifically are susceptible just in that, like, we see how this system works. So if you're like, if the system itself is rigged, what else is like possible? And I think it can lead you down these really crazy roads where like, you've never found yourself in the barbershop and they're watching one of these YouTube videos and it's like, Prince predicted 9/11. And you're like, how did we get here?
And then there's a dude who's in charge of your hair being like, this is legitimate. And you can't really argue with it because what are you going to do? Look dumb.
I remember the guy was like, I've known Prince's voice my whole life. That's Prince. And I was like, all right.
Are there any of those conspiracy theories that you think are more fact than fiction?
That's difficult because I think a lot of them are based in some type of fact and then they spin off is kind of how I view it.
Yeah, I think conspiracy theories are honestly more a symptom of fan fiction than they are fictitious, if that makes sense. It's a lot of them are rooted in a type of truth and then somebody gets a little crazy with the way that they're going to write about these things. Like even, you know, we've unpacked old episodes of like that conspiracy theory that Tommy Hilfiger went on Oprah and said that he didn't want black people wearing his clothes.
And baby, everybody knew that one.
Everyone claimed to have seen the episode where the man said it, and it's not true at all. Tommy Hilfiger never said that. He never even kind of was. I don't even think he was on Oprah at the point that he was being accused of having said that. However, what is true is that there is a history in certainly high fashion of exclusion and sort of intentional separation of these races and compartmentalizing the people who are belonging in the clothes. And so like, nah, Tommy Hilfiger didn't do it, but if we pretend like high fashion hasn't like intentionally kept black people out of it, we're being silly. So if Tommy Hilfiger falls in it, I don't care. I don't know. That's funny to me.
It wasn't funny to Tommy. That was a moment. Now, I'd love to ask you all, you obviously have seen the conversation about some other comedians who people experience them as transphobic and homophobic and or sort of against the woke conversation, right? Like sort of issues that people like me would be very, like, this is the work that I do every day. And people are like, you're too woke and da-da. How do you enter into those conversations where people feel like not everything is up for a joke or some of the jokes harm communities and we shouldn't participate in them if they actually do inflict harm on communities, even if they are funny? How do you find yourself in that conversation?
I imagine our answers may not be completely aligned. I'm not sure. I would say that for me personally, I do not believe that there's any version of like some woke space that can't be touched or like there's an attack on the truth that the way that maybe an older class of comedian might pitch. I think what I do believe is that especially for our podcast and my own comedy personally, my goal is to never be talking about anything that I can't speak about from some version of a personal experience. So even if it is the personal experience is truly doing research to try to learn about these things and unpack the true or false evidence that I've uncovered, I don't want this to be weaponized against another community as much as exposing the silly that is underneath everything. So I do think that there are ways that we can talk about trans rights and talk about sort of like queer activism or any issues that are sort of like big hot button issues right now without being like, ha, 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 you silly trans people. It's more of like, hey, this is objectively funny. We can agree that this part's silly and the other parts that are being weaponized, we can acknowledge without pointing a finger or making someone feel bad.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that to a point. I think also there's you can't, if you don't allow people to talk about these things and explore these boundaries, then you're just gonna, it's gonna breed contempt and resentment. Mm-hmm. If people, and I think a lot of times learning about some of these bigger concepts for some of these guys are just like, they're 65. It's a tough thing for them to figure out. You know what I mean? So when they try to push against the walls, it's going to be it's going to sound kind of like uncouth or however we feel. But I think there's a level of, I think it bums me out that there's not like a level of dialogue back and forth where these, because these comics are like in an echo chamber as well, right? So it's like, I wish that somebody could, like Dave Chappelle had a young person who could be like, okay, I understand why you think that, dummy, but here's what's really going on. But it's like, these people are all, he only interacts with like the internet, you know what I mean? So it like doesn't help for that thing. But I definitely am on board with like, you got to be able to talk about anything, because if you don't, that's what starts to breed resentment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, this is a push to understand, not a push to challenge. Is I want to understand better how you, what, if at all, is there responsibility of the comic to, or what is the responsibility, if any, of the comic to like not engage in harm, I think is, but that like doesn't sound, let me give you an example. Is that like, cause I don't think I'm saying, can you talk about it? Cause I am with you on the, can you talk about it?
Sure.
But there are a lot of things that like, I could probably talk about poorly, right? That I like, should my right to talk about it is sort of whatever. But like me fumbling through it, like I'm not convinced I should fumble through some topics in public. It's sort of my offering. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that, right. And that some of the fumbling through it is I like might do damage in the fumble because I don't know what I'm talking about, which is different than like, can I? It's like, I mean, I can. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are parts of that I 100% agree with. My microphone is being icky. There are parts of it that I 100% agree with that like, yeah, it's not dope to fumble through things that are potentially dangerous, right? Harmful for another person's livelihood, their comforts, all of that stuff. And then I think there are things that are like, we're fumbling through it because that's part of what life is. And so I think it's a romantic little balance, if I'm being honest with you. I think that like comedians are often still figuring out that balance because we are weirdos and artists and frankly should not be anyone's heroes, and are sometimes pinned in a position where for a very brief moment we are heroes, or at least our greatest are treated as such. But I assure you, they're not heroes. And so I think it's a game that we're all managing and need to probably manage better, but it doesn't change the reality, which is some of those fumbles are really useful conversation and some of those fumbles are potentially harmful. And we have to do better when we can to at least pull back on the fumbles that are harmful while still like tiptoeing and doing all the other stuff, because that's what our art form is.
And I mean, that's the thing is like a lot of to get to it, to get through the fumbles, especially with comedy, is like to get through the fumbles, it is to have to talk about it. So it's, I have to run this joke in front of a bunch of people and see how it works before I even get to a place where I'm like, oh, this is good. I can put this out. Like, that's just the trial and error of what this is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? If you're not allowed to do that, then you're not really ever going to get to a point where it's good.
And I do think that to that, there's a very big difference between somebody going up on stage and being like, what the fuck is up with trans people, versus somebody speaking from a personal perspective. To me, right. Like even like in Chappelle's 5-year now run of trans exploration, the part that felt the most like useful, honest, whatever, was the part where he was unpacking the weird friendship he had built with the trans audience member that was coming to see him. We're talking about something useful to the conversation. So again, the personal and really driving from what you know and not just speculation and sort of like mean words feels like where comedy needs to be if it's really going to protect the people inside of the jokes at all times.
So last push on this, and Bori, I think this is more of a push for you because you're the person who said it, is I'm trying to figure out, and I think this is actually what we get pressed about a lot with the comedians, which is why I'm pressing you, because you actually are a comedian. You both are comedians. is I don't think you would agree that people, like if a white person got on stage and fumbled through should they say the N-word or not and repeatedly said the N-word, we would say that that was unacceptable. I believe, like, activist me would definitely say that was unacceptable.
I've seen it.
I mean, which doesn't make it, I mean, I've seen a lot of things that aren't acceptable. You would say that was okay? That's my push. That's what I'm trying to like understand. Where's the fault line?
I think the space for growth is always okay, right? If that's what's really the
growth, you know it's wrong. That white people know it's wrong to say. Like, why do I need to like?
I think some of these. I think some of these people and these aspects where you have seen it. I think these guys think that they are cutting edge for their art more than they think that they are. They understand the damage that that word does do, and I think how do you learn what the damage that word does do? Say it in front of some black people. See how it goes.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes there's like that level of, and I understand the size of, because you're worried about the size, right? The size of like a Dave. Like when you're talking about what comedians should and shouldn't fumble through, you're not talking about Joe Blow comedian in open mic. You're talking about Dave Chappelle. You're talking about.
No, I think the open mic matters too. I think what I want to acknowledge, what I'm sort of trying to push on, and I don't know the answers, but I'm earnestly asking you, is that like the sometimes words open up space that create like that do real damage. So I think about like when I, as a young gay black kid growing up, when people said faggot in a room I was in, it like did something very, it wasn't a throwaway word. It wasn't casual. It wasn't random. Like the word opened up space that like could hurt me in a very visceral way. It wasn't just a word. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I definitely understand that.
So I never want to minimize, and I like totally hear you. I hear the fumble thing. I'm like, people should learn and grow. I get that too. So when I think about rooms of, like, I think about a room where there are a couple black people and not a lot of black people and a white person's like fumbling through, in air quotes, using the N-word, that space is just different all of a sudden. It's no longer, like for those black people, the space is different. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I've been in that position. I think to get anywhere is, you know, it's ugly. I just think that cutting it off completely is not really the wave, man.
I guess for me, I feel like so many of sort of like the premises of like the white comedian who's in a room saying the N-word and sort of like being harmful in that way is kind of antiquated to some extent. Like it's not even a game that they're playing anymore. And I think that we also have to be tracking what the actual like harmful games are and not just sort of like getting caught up at like the open, like that is a very open mic thing to sort of like Joe Rogan's already apologized for his N words. Like they've moved past that version of it. And now their games are a different kind of game where they use coded words and sort of like very intentionally clean language in order to be offensive or strategic against communities that they want to harm. And so for me, it's less about like picking apart the words, right? And being like, you can't say this, you can't say that, but more being like, hey, I'm clocking what the intention is underneath this thing. I'm clocking the want that lives inside of your comedy. So, you know, and maybe Bori, this is also where you're at, but like for me, comedy is less about like policing the language and more about identifying the actual people who intend harm and want to make people feel worse inside of this thing.
I think so for sure. Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay. I cannot thank you for us working through that together.
Hell yeah.
Back to your podcast. tell me a guest you'll never forget.
Oh. We've had some pretty great people on the podcast.
Never forget.
We've had Yasser Lester, who is always phenomenal.
You're answering a different question.
Oh well, I'm trying to get to the
yeah. Try to get to
I like Yasser though. Yasser's great.
No, unacceptable answer. You made that clear. We'll give you a better one.
I mean, I think Yamanika for me, as far as
Yamanika, I think it was great.
Langston and I both really delight when the conversation gets very wild and kind of goes way off track, and we start talking about some really crazy stuff. And that's, I think that Yamanika Saunders talking about the ghosts surrounding her genitals was a pretty exciting episode.
Okay, that is not where I thought that was going to go with the ghost, but here we are.
Yamanika Saunders is an amazing comedian and truly took over our podcast in a way that no other human being probably ever has. So, yeah, I think Yamanika is a great answer to that question. Forget Yasser. He's out of
here. Yasser's out of here.
And then if new listeners had to start somewhere, which episode should they start with?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that we tend to cover a range of topics. They are sometimes very like difficult topics where it's like things that are rooted in sort of like challenging conversations. And then there are a lot of silly billy topics that are a lot more palatable and easy to enter on. I think our mini episodes on Thursdays tend to be very easy, palatable conversations and are rarely like deeply offensive to people. So maybe start with the mini episode. It's me and Bori just riffing on emails that our listeners sent to us. And then if that feels good to you, you work your way up to a big old regular episode, you know?
I say jump in, Brandon Kyle Goodman, the myth of the black phallus. Or I mean, whatever. Or I also think Jay Jordan. What was Jay Jordan? My mama told me if you leave your hair wet, you'll get a cold. You'll catch a cold.
Yeah, that's a nice point. And Jay's really funny and that one got a little chaotic in a beautiful way. So yeah. Jay's a great answer.
And Langston, I believe you're a father. Yes,
I am. They're going to take this baby away any day now. But yeah, no, for now, sure.
I'd love to know how fatherhood has impacted the way you think about the storytelling part of comedy, if at all, or if it has influenced the way you think about comedy's role in society or not.
I think my baby is young. She's a year and a half, so she doesn't understand certainly work or the work that I do. So it hasn't affected my fear of like, oh, she's going to see this and I have to be more careful kind of thing. But I do think it certainly has made me feel like, I think what fatherhood has done most importantly has made me very aware of the small moments that influence our larger interpretations of the world. And so it I think maybe makes me zero in harder on those small moments and not just sort of glaze over them because it's just a part of life, whatever, whatever. But I'm like, every moment kind of matters now because I'm watching it matter so much to a little person, right? Like she watched something that like a person squeezed a baby's cheeks. And now she is walking around our neighborhood, seeing other children and squeezing their cheeks because she thinks that that is cute and a way of showing respect to these other babies who do not like it at all. They don't care for it one bit, but this is what she wants to do. And that's a small moment that created this larger interpretation of the world for her. And I think I am zeroed in, I think, in a lot of ways on those kinds of things, both for my child and the world at large, if that makes sense.
Boom. There are two questions we ask everybody. The first is, what's a piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that's always stuck with you?
Boy, you want to go first or you want me to do this? I got something in my head.
Oh, I mean, always, my mom told me, when people show you who they are, listen.
Yeah.
That's always helped me out. You know what I mean? Don't pay attention.
Yeah. I like that. Somebody on Twitter once said, don't stand still on an escalator. Life's too short to stand still on an escalator. And I don't know why that lives with me, but it lives with me forever. Like it feels like, God, I gotta get moving.
I gotta take the stairs.
What am I doing? I'm standing on this escalator. I gotta move.
Don't stand still on the escalator. Okay. And the second question is, what do you say to people who feel like they've done all the things? They've listened to your podcast, listened to mine. They've read the books. They were in the street. They testified. They voted. And the world hasn't changed in the way they wanted it to yet. What do you say to those people, the people whose hope is challenged in moments like this?
And I think it's maybe the motivation that lives underneath our podcast is to find ways to experience joy in the hard conversations. I think that is the most important thing that we sort of aim for inside of our pod is like, we should be laughing at things that are difficult, things that make us uncomfortable, things that maybe are constantly returning us to that sad place, that sort of like inevitable defeat that we keep feeling. And so I would say the best I can offer you is find something that makes you laugh, even if you're laughing at the thing that you're trying to fix. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Gratitude is the attitude, right? When you feel hopeless or whatever, those are the times I think, at least for me, that's when I lean into like my community or my family or Sierra Leone in general. Like, I think just kind of refocusing on the things that you can change and the people that you love. In your community, that really goes a long way.
Yeah. Good answers all around, I'd say.
So let people know where they can go to stay in touch with you, where they can find the latest updates. How do people stay tuned?
I have a small internet footprint. You can find me on Cool Guy Instagram at CoolGuyJokes87. Other than that, you know, don't worry. Listen to the podcast. It'll be all right.
Yeah, listen to My Mama Told Me. It's a very silly podcast, and maybe you'll learn something, huh? And you can follow me at Langston Kerman on Instagram, and I'm finally free of Twitter. So yeah, just Instagram at this point.
Boom. Well, we consider you friends of the pod and can't wait to have you back.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out and make sure you rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Evan Sutton. Executive produced by me. And special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.